Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. For this episode, journalist Paul Kelly joins us to talk about last month's Australian federal election. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
I hope you all enjoyed the little Leonard Cohen waiting for the miracle. Got the reference just to warm us up. It's such a pleasure to be here with Paul Kelly this evening. I thought we could retitle this event "In Retrospect, Everything Looks Obvious," but it doesn't. I think it's more complicated than that. But to talk about what's happened with the recent federal election, I'm sure all of you know Paul Kelly's work. He's the editor at large at The Australian, formerly the editor in chief there, the author of 9. Very important books about Australian political history and political culture, including The End of Certainty, Triumph and Demise, The March of Patriots, numerous books on Gough Whitlam and the dismissal, and The Hawke Ascendancy. And I was going to bring all my copies of Paul's book, but that's just a recipe for fibromyalgia, I think. So I brought one, and I chose a book that's very important to me, the Hawke Ascendancy, and this is an original edition. It's important to me, Paul, because when I left home at the age of 15, I was reading it. This was the book I was reading it, and I stole it from my father. His signature and date is still in it, and I never gave it back. And it was important because it was the first serious political book I ever read. And so I thought I'd bring it in tonight as a rounding of everything that's gone on, of course, including the death of Bob Hawke. And I want to start with that dramatic departure, the timing of that. The very last words you write in this book: "Hawke is a unique product of Australian democracy. Perhaps because the public identifies so closely with him, Hawke's progress will reveal our own future as a nation." And I was thinking about those words in relation to his memorial last week, which I thought was the best public event Australia's put on probably since the Olympics. Your sense of it?
I was at the event, Sally. I should begin by saying that it's a great pleasure for me to be joining you tonight at the Wheeler Centre. The Hawke Memorial was an emotional and intellectual and a truly brilliant event. And when Australia as a country does things well, we do display a touch of genius. There were a number of outstanding speakers, and they all delivered their own very unique perspective on Bob Hawke, reflecting not just on Hawke's character, but their own character. And I think one of the underlying messages for me, just listening to the speeches and being at the event, was that it told us about the Australian character and Hawke's great genius to bring people together. And he certainly achieved that at the zenith in his death.
Give us a few reflections on how you felt. The timing of his death was kind of remarkable, and I think the feeling at that moment, just a couple of days before the election, I think lots of people sort of saw this as, well, he didn't quite have time to vote, but it doesn't matter because, you know, the Bill Shorten's, you know, riding in on a wave. I wondered a bit whether it would remind people of what Bill Shorten wasn't.
Well, look, the joke in sad reflection of Hawke and tribute to Hawke was that this may well be Hawke's final election victory. That is, people were assuming that Hawke's death so close to the vote would assist the Labor Party. It's very hard to assess what impact it had. I'm inclined to think at the end of the day that it didn't have much impact on the vote at all. That is that Australians had their own view of Hawke, their own view of Bob Hawke's death. And I don't think that particularly affected the way a lot of very down-to-earth, practical and pragmatic Australians voted when they went into the ballot box.
Well, let's talk about what did matter. And one of the other things that you wrote was, does Labor begin to grasp how utterly it is divorced from the ethos and ideas that drove Hawke? Labor's 2019 agenda more resembles what Hawke was criticising, not what he was advocating.
I feel very strongly about this. I covered the Hawke government very closely, and I was a very strong supporter at the time of Hawke-Keating policies, and in particular Hawke-Keating economic reforms. But what Hawke did was, Hawke was an agent of consensus. He was an advocate of reconciliation. He did bring the country together. These weren't slogans. These weren't meaningless words that he uttered. This came from the heart of the man. It came from Hawke's essence, and it came from Hawke's understanding of the Australian people and his understanding of Australian society. Hawke believed he had a special relationship and a rapport with the people, but he didn't just take that as some sort of convenient indulgence for himself. He turned it into a method of government, and that's an extraordinary thing to do, but he did. And essentially from the time of the 1983 election campaign through to the National Economic Summit and then the way he governed over many years, Hawke tried to bring people together and to negotiate outcomes and negotiate compromises and find midpoints of agreement both within the Labor Party and then between the government and the people. And this was a method and style of government, and it proved to be the most successful style of government for any Labor government in our history. And that is a function of Hawke's personality. Now, what irritates me is, frankly, the agenda Bill Shorten took to the election in virtually every respect was a very divisive agenda. If it came to generational change, he was promoting the younger generation and punishing the older generation. When it came to climate change, he was rewarding renewables and punishing coal. When it came to redistribution, he was attacking the asset class and attacking high-income earners and rewarding people, if you like, who were earning below about $90,000 a year. When it came to social and cultural issues, he was very unsympathetic to believers and to Christians and promoting the interests of minority groups in the LGBTI community. So if you look at virtually every aspect of Shorten's agenda, it was a divisive agenda based on what I think is the defect in progressive politics, which is essentially we're here to change the established order, to change the established norms, but do that in a way such that we punish one group and reward another. That was the opposite of Bob Hawke's consensus and reconciliation.
The agenda that Bill Shorten was promoting, there's a line, I think it's in Triumph and Demise, a Ken Henry quote about that the best leaders are those that are just in front of where they think public opinion could possibly land. So did Bill Shorten misread everything?
I think he misread a lot, but I do want to be fair to him. So did a lot of other people, and I would include myself in that in a number of respects. Let me try and unpack this a little bit. Shorten ran on an agenda of sweeping change, and his ego and confidence were such that towards the end of the campaign, he imitated Gough Whitlam and went back to the Blacktown Centre in Sydney, where Whitlam had launched the famous 1972 It's Time election. And essentially what he was trying to do was not just rekindle that idea, but really say, this is where we are now. This is another It's Time event. Well, it wasn't. It wasn't. I had a discussion with John Howard in January, and he said the interesting thing about the electorate at the moment is, while they're very dissatisfied with the government, and there are all sorts of things the government's done that they don't like, there's no deep-seated mood for change. And I thought about that a lot. And it's certainly true that the mood was not like 1972 with Whitlam. It wasn't like 1983 with Hawke. And it wasn't like 2007 with the Kevin 07 enthusiastic change agenda. And in the last week of the election campaign, the final piece I wrote, which appeared on the Saturday morning, the day of the election, I said, well, there's a paradox about this election because I don't think the public want the shortened agenda. I see no enthusiasm at all for the shortened agenda, yet it looks like there'll be a change of government because the polls are pointing to what is likely to be a change of government in a relatively tight election. And so there's a paradox here. Well, we know how the paradox was eventually resolved.
Well, there were sort of several paradoxes, weren't there? I mean, the other one is that the people who seemingly had the most to gain from the agenda that Shorten was promoting were the people that didn't vote for him, and the people that had the... It seemed like a reversal of people's own interests. Can you...
Well, this is fascinating, and we have to investigate this a lot more, but I'd make a few points about this. And your point, Sally, is that what essentially happened was that Shorten's running on a redistribution agenda, yet people who are better off, who are likely to be victims of this agenda, tended to vote Labor. And people who were less better off, who were likely to be the beneficiaries of the Labor agenda, tended to vote Liberal. Well, I make the following points. I think voting now is decoupled from occupation. So in that sense, there's been a fundamental change in the class-based nature of Australian politics as it relates to occupation. Occupation is not a good guide anymore to how people will vote, Labor or Liberal. Now, this is a fundamental change from where we've been for most of our history as a country. Secondly, like a number of other Western societies, we have moved into a post-materialist age. And increasingly, there are people who are wealthy, who've been successful, who are highly educated. Those people who are well off and highly educated tend to be more influenced by post-material factors than material factors. Not all of them, but quite a few of them. And so in that sense, they tend to vote for a climate change agenda or for some of the values-based aspects of progressive agenda. And so I think this is an important element. So that explains a lot of people in those electorates voting Labor rather than voting Liberal. But the other relevant point to make about this is, and this relates very importantly to aspirational voters, class still matters, I think, in the sense of an asset-owning class. Now, the asset-owning class in Australia is a widely diverse class. We're talking now about people interested in assets such as their own home, investment properties, shares, superannuation, retirement income assets. And the interesting thing about the Labor agenda, when you look at the Labor agenda is a comprehensive assault on the asset-owning class. And that asset-owning class stretches right across the income spectrum. So I tend to think there's a lot in this particular piece of analysis in terms of explaining the result.
The idea certainly with the media, I think too, was this idea that a progressive Australia was in, that it had arrived. I mean, did you? I mean, certainly in the media, did it surprise you, or I mean, how did you feel about it? I suppose with the result that, you know, everybody missed it. I mean, it does seem so obvious now, doesn't it? And even though, of course, there are really important differences, people are very quick to jump to Brexit or jump to Trump's election. The things that mattered in the end to this result were actually all really identifiable. So why weren't they identified? And I suppose specifically, what do you do about news poll? Now.
Well, let me. I'm happy to talk about the polls, but Let me just deal with the first question you've asked, which is a really fundamental question. There's no doubt that Australia is becoming a more progressive country, and there's much evidence of that. But Labor made a mistake. Labor exaggerated the extent of that change. Now, again, Labor wasn't alone in doing that. And there was a lot of evidence to substantiate what Labor thought. There was, for example, the same-sex marriage plebiscite where there was a very strong vote for same-sex marriage, including from a number of Coalition and National Party electorates. There was a sense that the country was becoming more compassionate, more caring about issues relating to violence, domestic violence, concern about minority rights, a sense that Australian politics was becoming more feminised. Then there was the climate change issue, and this was particularly important after Turnbull was deposed in August 2018. And you had the Wentworth by-election with Karen Phillips winning the Wentworth by-election, running very much on a climate change agenda, and then a sense of the rise of the independents and a much greater awareness of climate change. This was also tied in to the electorate's concern about the banks, about big business, about the abuse of power in the banking sector and in financial markets, and concern about the fair go. So when you put all this together, when you put it all together, there are a lot of economic, financial, social and cultural factors pointing to a more progressive Australia. Labor got intoxicated by this. There's no question. And at the end of the day, they did misread it. But to be fair to them, and I think at some point we'll talk about the Liberal Party, but what happened was that Labor misinterpreted the confusion and division on the coalition side for voter endorsement of the Labor agenda. And essentially what happened for most of the last term was that the coalition government had forfeited the right to govern, essentially because of divisions in its own ranks and the inability of Malcolm Turnbull to unite his own party and unite the government. So they were sitting in a situation where they were not going to be elected. They were not going to be re-elected, and they had forfeited their right to govern. Now, that was the environment in which Labor formulated all these policies. And I think one of the mistakes that Labor made was that it got confused and it misinterpreted the fact that the coalition was not a viable force electorally for the voter endorsement of Labor's own progressive agenda. And what happened after Morrison became Prime Minister was that eventually over a period of 6 months of very intensive political activity, he transformed the environment. And this was the fundamental event. So Labor was actually left with a set of policies devised to beat a government that didn't exist anymore. The key event is Morrison. No other Liberal could have won. Abbott couldn't have won. Turnbull couldn't have won. Only Morrison could have won. Morrison was able to unite the government and then create a different atmospheric about the government. And that different atmospheric exposed Labor.
Tell us more about that now that we have, you know, finally gotten on to Scott Morrison. I mean, in a way, it's sort of reflects the campaign, doesn't it, that it was all about Labor's policies and what they were going to do, and the coalition just seemed to, you know, go under the radar somewhat and let them do it. But you know, what did we fail to understand about Scott Morrison?
Well, again, I think what you said at the start's right. Everything looks a lot more obvious in retrospect. In retrospect, we're all so smart. We're all so clever, and we think, well, that was just so obvious, wasn't it? But the truth is it wasn't at the time. So Morrison is a community-based politician. You could not think of a Liberal leader more distant from the big end of town. He is the common man as Prime Minister. He was the former Liberal Party director in New South Wales running Liberal campaigns. He is the campaign director as Prime Minister. He's got a very good feel for the Australian public, better than Abbott, better than Turnbull. He has got insights, I think, into the public that are very interesting, and his approach is to try and bring people together. That's what Morrison tries to do. Now, if we look at his agenda, he ran on a modest agenda. Essentially, he ran on the budget. But the point about the budget was that it didn't hurt anybody. So there's virtually nobody being hurt in the Morrison agenda. And you've got to look at what Morrison stands for in economic terms. He's not interested in these theoretical debates about government intervention versus the free market. He's practical, he's pragmatic, he's interested in results. So he was committed, number one, to jobs, wages, economic growth. Two, big tax cuts for everybody, and three, strong service delivery in terms of health, education, and welfare services. Now, that's actually not a bad agenda. So that was the Morrison agenda. And having devised that agenda, then he was prepared to run a very aggressive, negative campaign against Shorten, who was sitting out there with his big target agenda that he had judged, I believe, correctly, would have worked against Turnbull, but ended up not working against Morrison.
Morrison's agenda, though, is a one that, I mean, there's not any real reform there, is there? You've written and thought so much about reform over your years in journalism and writing, and you know, you've written that a government, you know, where there's no sign of reform is. Where a country is led by that, it'll be a country in decline. So what does that mean for Australia that we've now got a government that doesn't seem to be interested really in anything particular except tax?
Well, what it means is... what it means is we've got a government that's reflective of the times. And one of the things I've written about now for the past 10 years is that the reform age in Australia is dead. I think this was the case under Labor. I think it's been the case under this Liberal government. It's not to say that they're not changing things, but the reform age, as I understood the reform age, under Hawke Keating and most of John Howard, was a reform age in which we are attempting to make Australia a more prosperous society, a society which has got the capacity to change, to be integrated into global markets and to be a success at this point in time globally. But of course, the world is changing. This is the world of Brexit, it's the world of Trump, and it's the world where Western democracies are not performing correctly. And in this sense, Australia is doing better than a lot of other Western democracies. But we are not living up to our mission as a country. We are not delivering world's best practice, which is what we aspired to do in the reform age. So I think this is a problem, and I've said it's a problem not just of inadequate political leadership, but it's a problem of the system. The system is not functioning anymore, and we've seen evidence of this under both Labor and Liberal governments. So that's the environment, and that's the climate in which you've got to look at this most recent election. Now, two things happened at this most recent election. Labor said, we're going to be audacious, and Labor put together a very audacious agenda. It was a big target agenda, and they were basically aiming to fundamentally change the country. Now, what I think about that agenda was I think it's a flawed agenda, a deeply flawed agenda. I'm happy to talk about that, but that's on the Labor side. What happened on the Liberal side was that they had actually been running through two governments, the Abbott government and the Turnbull government, neither of which was successful. So Morrison's task was to actually win an election, not devise a reform agenda. He wasn't attempting to do that in any way, shape or form, and he was very open about that. But he had some interesting insights. I interviewed Morrison a week and a half before voting day, and what he said to me was, he said, the public don't want grand plans. The public are really suspicious of politicians who come up with complicated and far-reaching and sophisticated agendas, and they think those sort of agendas don't work anymore. I'm not doing that. I'm actually delivering an agenda which is very simple, very direct, very straightforward, very honest. It was also very limited. He didn't say that. But nonetheless, what he had to say, what he had to say about where the Australian voters are and where our political culture is, was deeply revealing. And I can only conclude that the result of this election reflects where our culture is.
He read the room.
He read the room. Do we have a problem because the reform age is dead? I'll say we do. We are storing up a lot of difficulties for ourselves down the track as a country.
How can that, and how and when do you think we could break? I mean, I sort of read that agenda as ending with the assassination of Rudd. He was the last leader to even really attempt a kind of coordinated reform agenda, and everything's been pretty crazy since then, along with the other bigger structural issues around the world that you talked about. How do you get it back, and when?
I don't know the answer to that question. This is the question that I've thought about more than virtually anything else in the last decade as I've covered politics, and the answer is not apparent to me. Let me make a couple of points. I mean, regardless of what you think of Morrison, Morrison's central campaign pledge that he talked about every day was his tax package spread out over the next 6 years. Now, if there's such a thing as a mandate, he has a mandate for that package. But there is no certainty at all that he will be able to secure that package through the Parliament.
Well, he might need another miracle too in terms of the economic headwinds, you would assume, to get all that.
Well, the economic headwinds, again, is a separate issue. I mean, that is a very significant challenge for this government. There is a very significant economic slowdown underway. The Reserve Bank governor has made this very clear. What we're seeing is the decline of the effectiveness of monetary policy, that is interest rate cuts, because interest rates are so low. We're seeing the negation of Milton Friedman's famous line that inflation anywhere and everywhere is a monetary phenomenon. That's no longer the case, essentially because of two global transforming events: the rise of the digital economy and the rise of globalization. And essentially what this means is that people can run low-cost businesses. What's happening with the Australian economy today is that growth is going into job creation and corporate profits, and it's not going into wages. And this is a similar phenomenon from around the world. So if you're a politician interested in living standards and the welfare of the Australian public, as all politicians are, you've got to get wages up. But getting up wages when you've got entrenched low inflation is very difficult. So the Reserve Bank governor has announced to the government and announced to the Australian public that cutting interest rates won't do the job anymore. What's got to happen is governments have got to do more. Governments have got to make a greater contribution in terms of productivity, in terms of economic reform, in terms of getting the system more lubricated and functioning a lot better. Now, the difficult thing for government to do that is that involves a lot of hard decisions. Hard decisions put governments in jeopardy. You said earlier on that the art of politics, as far as Ken Henry said, was for the politician to stay just a little bit in front of public opinion. That's what Hawke did. Paul Keating's problem was he got too far in front of public opinion and paid the price. Where our politicians are today is that they attempt just to reflect public opinion in order to play it safe. Now, that's not going to work. That's not true leadership.
Scott Morrison will have a lot to do in thinking deeply about how to bring this country together, because it is quite divided. You only have to look at where the votes fell, how they fell. How does he... I mean, some of his problems are literally gone now, like Tony Abbott, you know, and to have the authority of his sensational victory. But how can he best go about doing that? And so for the people, particularly people that were so invested in a Labor victory, I suppose, whose fears are that the old fights are just all going to be brought back but raised even more.
Well, I can offer you some thoughts, but I don't know the answer to that question, and perhaps Scott Morrison doesn't properly know the answer to that question. We've got some different perspectives here. This election was almost exactly a status quo election. The government has gone from 76 seats 3 years ago to 77, and Labor's only changed by one seat. So it's been a remarkably status quo election in that sense. But it's an extraordinary election in another sense, in as much as what it's told us is that Labor's audacious progressive agenda, while it carried two-thirds of the country, failed in the country as a whole. And it's not good enough winning two-thirds of the country. Australia is one country, and you've got to win that country. Now, Morrison proved that he has a better understanding of the country as a whole than does the Labor Party. The Labor Party is too much the party of the urban cultural dynamic. The Labor primary vote is 33.5 at this election. The Liberal primary vote, the coalition primary vote, is 41.5. There's a significant difference there, and that significant difference tells us the measure of a coalition which has got a broader grip across the country as a whole, and in particular, of course, won in Queensland and Western Australia so utterly convincingly that the coalition made up for its deficiencies in the four southern states with the magnitude of its victory in Queensland and Western Australia. Now, what's happening now, Sally, in this country is Australia's becoming a much more diverse and divided country in economic, social and cultural terms. The difference between central Queensland and Melbourne is greater than it's ever been before. Now, this is a challenge for both sides. It's a challenge for Labor. It's a challenge for the Coalition. What happened at this election was the Coalition managed to provide a better compromise set of policies and a better compromise set of rhetoric to the people in terms of attempting to span these divisions than did Labor. Now, that will give Morrison great heart in terms of the way he approaches the Prime Ministership. This is a different Liberal Party. The Abbott-Turnbull era is gone, and the divisions based on Abbott and Turnbull are gone. That's not to say there aren't differences in the party. There are. But that cabinet is very united now around Morrison. The question is, does Morrison have the skills to be able to meet these challenges of an economy slowing down, a country which is very different in cultural and economic terms, and a country where a Prime Minister has got to attempt to reconcile central Queensland with Melbourne? We haven't seen this sort of challenge before.
I read an interesting piece by George Megalogenis recently, and his, it's kind of ridiculous to speculate already on where this might be heading in 3 years' time, but he reminded me that in every other situation where you've had a shock victory with not a lot of policy, it's ended up in defeat next time round. So Keating is the obvious one, but also Fraser, or a set of circumstances as unexpected as these were. My reading of it is quite different, and it links to what you just said then, that I've got this feeling in the great Australian and generous and usually correct Australian tradition of giving governments a second term, this feels like it's being treated as a first-term government, this Morrison government, not a third-term government. That there's just a vibe that there's been a line drawn, which would tend to make me feel he could assume a second term if he doesn't do anything really stupid. I'm wondering which of those two thoughts you think is more likely.
I'm very much on your side in terms of that interpretation vis-a-vis George. It's interesting, isn't it? Morrison is a new Prime Minister. He's only been Prime Minister for a very short period of time. Many people are still getting a feel for what sort of person and individual he is. And I think this is an advantage for Morrison. Yet it's a third-term government. And we've had three elections in a row with three coalition victories under three different prime ministers. Tony Abbott 2013, Malcolm Turnbull 2016, Scott Morrison 2019. This is most unusual. We had stability on the Labor side, Bill Shorten as Labor leader the entire time. Normally you would have thought that the public would reward the side that's stable, that is the Labor side, and penalise the side that was showing signs of instability, that is the Coalition side, but that didn't happen. So that's an interesting paradox. Morrison does have an advantage because there's no obvious rival. There isn't a rival to him, and there won't be a rival to him for the next 3 years. So while he will get into all sorts of troubles and tribulations, that is not going to lead to another leadership crisis the way we've seen this coalition government, this Liberal Party, involved in leadership tribulations in the previous two terms. That's an advantage for Morrison. The fact that Morrison is a community-based politician with a better capacity to understand the people and relate to the people is important. The fact that he wants to govern, as he says, from the middle. He's not a Tony Abbott governing from the conservative side. He's not a Malcolm Turnbull governing from the progressive side of the non-Labor side of politics. He is governing from the middle. And he's going to govern in terms of a dialogue with the people. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But I think in terms of those points I've just highlighted, this to me is a pretty different situation to what happened in 1993. The one qualification, of course, is that the longer a government stays in office, the more potentially difficult the next election is. That's always the case.
Labor must be just wondering what it has to do in terms of the seemingly free ride about the leadership turmoil, that when you think about what they endured after Rudd the first was rolled and then Julia Gillard and now it just seems that the coalition just did it better, didn't they? The Liberal Party just, they were just better at it.
Well, look, we have to recognise that in August last year, when Peter Dutton challenged Malcolm Turnbull for the leadership, most commentators, including myself, felt that this was a doomed project. When Scott Morrison emerged as the leader, I said, well, this was clearly the best result for the government. Clearly the best result for the government, given that Turnbull had lost the confidence of the parliamentary party. I did not believe at that point in time that Morrison would win the election. I felt the turmoil in the government would be such that there would be still a residue of that turmoil at the next election, that this would penalise Morrison and that Labor would be vindicated in terms of its strategy and that Labor would win the election. Now, that's what I thought last August. And I can tell you that's what a lot of politicians on both sides of politics felt. A lot felt that as well. So it comes back to the fact that Morrison performed better than virtually anybody expected that he would. That doesn't mean that he'll necessarily be an impressive Prime Minister. We'll have to see. But what we can say is that he surprised people on the upside, and certainly he surprised the Labor Party on the upside.
Obviously, Anthony Albanese has now taken over, and he said that all of the Labor policies will be examined. But he's, and I think this is quite crucial, he said that the values of the party won't be. Is that something that needs to be done, do you think, in the Labor Party?
Well, I've attacked that comment. I disagree with that comment, and I think this is one of the problems the Labor Party's got. There's this mantra all the time from the Labor Party. Our values are wonderful. Our values are terrific. Our values enshrine our heart and our virtue. We will never change our values. Policies? We'll be pragmatic and we'll change our policies. Well, all I can say is when you put yourself forward as the oldest and greatest party in Australian politics that aspires to govern the country in its own right, and you've got a primary vote of 33 1/3, and you've had a primary vote over the last four elections that hasn't been above 37%, and that you haven't had a decent primary vote since Kevin Rudd in 2007, you've got to start saying that your problems are far more deep-seated than just the policies you took to the most recent election. And I understand it's very difficult for Labor to do that. You need a Whitlam. You need a Whitlam figure who will stand up and say to the party, we are not going to tolerate this anymore, and I, as the leader, am going to call it out. Now, that's a very dangerous thing to do, because while Whitlam is a great historical figure, Whitlam came very close to the brink of failing when he was opposition leader. Eventually, Gough succeeded, and he reformed the party, and he modernised the party in a magnificent example of political courage and brinkmanship and crash through or crash politics, but he nearly crashed. So I don't see anybody in the Labor Party who is going to do anything like that. I think the Labor Party will continue to live within the confines of these parameters, that our values are right and true. We're not going to assess them. We'll just look at policies. That troubles me, because I fear that that is not going to provide the answer for Labor.
I felt a massive thing that troubled, troubled me, and it troubled lots of people I've spoken to, is that when a party, having gone through that, then can't find a way to keep somebody like Tanya Plibersek as its deputy, because there are these rules that people don't care about. People just don't care. I think they see somebody that was incredibly capable, somebody that the public know, somebody that wasn't vying for leadership, but rules like that that say, no, we can't have... If we've got one from the left, then we have to get rid of her. A lack of suppleness, a lack of flexibility in its structures that I thought was very troubling as a starting point to regrouping.
The factions are too dominant. I know it's an orthodox complaint, but it's true. It's true. One of the points that a couple of my old Labor colleagues make, I better not name them. They might
not
be a little
if they
bit,
work for your newspaper. You better not.
I better not name them in case they get embarrassed. But they say Whitlam wouldn't get pre-selection today, right. And the reason he wouldn't get pre-selection today is that the factional system dominates pre-selections. The factional system dominates the front bench. It dominates selections for the ministry. Look at what's going on with John Seatke today and the CFM MEU. Just look at this. I mean, the fact of the matter is that this fellow has been operating on borrowed time when it came to the Labor Party. Anthony Albanese is completely correct to seek to kick him out of the Labor Party. Bill Shorten didn't. Why didn't Bill Shorten? Because of the factional system. Because Shorten depended on that union. He depended on that union for all sorts of policy outcomes. And so this, I think, is the great difficulty of the party. And if we just... I'll just make another point about the relationship between the party and the unions. What's happening at the moment is that the union movement has very little industrial power. It has very little clout in the marketplace. I mean, this is obvious. Look at wage levels. Wage levels are so low. Sally McManus all the time is complaining about it. Well, what that tells us is that the unions don't have much industrial muscle. They can't negotiate higher wages. What the unions rely on, therefore, is they rely on having a Labor government that is going to introduce policies and pass laws and deliver the union's outcomes that the unions can't get for themselves in the marketplace. That's how it works. So what's happening to the union movement is the union movement is becoming very much a movement of political activists whose job is to try and ensure that Labor wins the election, and therefore, after Labor wins the election, to negotiate the best deal it can with Labor in terms of the policy outcomes. That's essentially what's happening at the moment. And look at the tragedy of this election. I mean, I don't know how much money the union spent. Was it $10 million? Was it $15 million? Was it upwards of $20 million of membership funds? And they lost. They lost. The Change the Rules campaign didn't work. And Labor didn't win the election. So there's a lot of difficulty here for the relationship between the party and the union movement, and it's just so utterly and completely different to the highly constructive relationship that Hawke and Keating had with the ACTU a generation ago.
I'm going to ask one more quick question and then we'll get a couple from the audience. And you've been at the Australian now for many years. You've been at the helm of it at one time. And I wonder your reflections on the bollocking it's getting from many, many quarters, not the Australian specifically, but the empire, about its role, particularly in election campaigns, and how it makes you feel as somebody that's been there for such a long time.
Well, look, Sally, I guess News Corporation got into a lot of trouble in the 1972 election campaign with its total commitment
to Whitlam,
to Gough Whitlam. Mm. And then, of course, when the Whitlam government disappointed, News Corporation became a very, very strong advocate of Malcolm Fraser. Particularly at the 1975 and 1977 election campaigns. So around the world, the nature of News Corporation for many decades, whether we're talking now about America or Britain or Australia, has been that it's been a company that has been aggressive in terms of identifying, for better or worse, the political party and the political leader that it thinks is the best for that country at any point in time. Witness, of course, Rupert's very strong support for Tony Blair. Now, the other point I'd make is that we are not unique. This is essentially the modus operandi of most of the media corporations that developed during the course of the industrial age in the 20th century.
But do you like it? Do you think it's a good approach? Does it make you feel sometimes, oh, there could be a better way, a bit of reform?
Well, there could always be a better way, and some of the instances we're talking about, if you look at agendas. I don't know, was it a good thing that Tony Blair reformed the British Labor Party and brought British Labor to power long, long before the Iraq War and modernised British Labor and virtually saved it? Was it a good thing that Kevin Rudd won the 2007 election when certainly the Australians supported Rudd very, very strongly at that election?
I think
the point is this. Is it better to have media corporations that have got the capacity to change their mind according to the circumstances rather than support one side all the time in fidelity to a particular class-based approach or cultural-based approach, which, by the way, was the way Australia tended to operate in terms of our media before the 1960s?
I would say if a newspaper or a news organisation could choose whichever it thought was best, and if it happened to be that same side for 100 years, so be it. My question is more about tone, that things have just become excessive in in campaigning against rather than for someone. And all those examples you gave are true. The Australian campaigned for Whitlam, for Tony Blair, for Kevin Rudd. It just feels now that there's shredding against in a way that is different.
Well, I agree completely with you on that. I think the tone of politics around the world has changed. The tone of media coverage has changed. The tone of our national life has changed. The tone of our public discourse. And I think this is a detrimental trend. I don't like it. I tend to be a little bit old-fashioned and obsolete. I mean, I'm responsible these days for what I write in the paper and for what I say on radio and television. And I try to be rational, sharp, fair and sensible about that. And I try and ensure that the tone that I adopt is a tone worthy of worthwhile debate. But social media has changed. I mean, the idea that, I mean, look at Donald Trump. I mean, it would have been inconceivable that someone like Donald Trump, with all the debasement that he represents, could have become President of the United States in earlier decades. And the fact that Trump has become president, to me, tells us about the nature of our societies these days, and it's not a good story. So I certainly agree with you on the point about tone.
Trump tweeted last night and put the incorrect link for ABC in his tweet. He meant to be the ABC in America, but he put our ABC. So it's social media following now is just, it's fantastical. It's just absolutely fantastic. We've got a couple of minutes. We've really stretched this conversation, but perhaps one or two, if you could keep the questions fairly brief.
Just wondering what you think of the universal basic income and whether that can be a policy reform for the 2022 election.
Labor looked at that. Chris Bowen looked at that in this most recent term, and Labor decided against it. I don't think Labor's position on that will change. The government, I don't think, will adopt it. I know there's quite a bit of support for the concept from the progressive side of politics, but it is a big change. It's a radical change, and I don't think the environment we're in at the moment, particularly with this economic slowdown of sorts and perhaps of major sorts, will be the environment in which that's likely to get up.
Hello. I'm most impressed by your two presentations and the way they're back and forth. I wanted to bring up CSIRO's Outlook report on the basis of its consultation, chaired, I think, by Ken Henry, whom each of you has mentioned. It says that Australia currently faces five enormous challenges, including climate change.
Yep. We won't be able to go through all five, just...
I promise. And the whole idea that we'll be in for a slow decline unless we meet these challenges. And I wonder how you feel about the new government's capacity to meet these five challenges.
Well, I've got the report. I've got a copy of the report in my briefcase, but I've got to admit to you, I'm yet to read it. I have spoken to Ken Henry about it. I spoke to him about it yesterday, and he thinks this is a very substantial work, and I'm certain it is. It represents a very substantial input by the CSIRO, and it's attempting to look at the interconnections in our society. You see, we've got to get away from looking at things just in silos, solving the problem of that silo and the problem of the next silo. I mean, our societies these days are dynamic, and we've got to capture that dynamic aspect in terms of our approach to issues. So I've been as I said, I haven't read this report, but I'm very sympathetic to what I think is the approach in this report, and that is that what we need is we need people from outside the political system coming together, working together in networks and attempting to find common ground and attempting to resolve problems themselves and devising shared foundations for new policy positions. This is what we need. And it's precisely because we've got difficulties within the political system. The political system has great trouble innovating at the moment simply because of the 24-hour political cycle. Because any time a politician ventures forth with an idea that might be halfway worthwhile, he's going to be attacked. He's going to be attacked because the negative is stronger than the positive these days. This is a function. This is a function of technology, the digital age, and the way the media works. And it means that the politicians are very, very conservative and cautious. Now, you can't just blame the politicians for being like that. What I always say is, I don't ask a politician to commit political suicide for a good cause. That's futile. That's absolutely futile. What I ask the politicians to do is to try and devise a policy structure in which they can move the country forward and they've got a chance of bringing people with them. Now, that's difficult. But a lot of our debate these days is a black and white debate, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work simply because an idea is put up and that idea is shot down because it's got no chance of getting support, and you can't then expect that the politicians are going to be anything other than cautious about the way they operate.
It's a very depressing note to end on, Paul, because, you know, what you say we need is, it just sounds like some sort of utopia that I really worry about Australia moment. And I think I would have been just as worried whoever had won the election, to be honest.
Well, if I can have a final, very brief word,
please.
Which would be an optimistic note on which to end. And I want to bookend at the start. Let's think about Bob Hawke. Let's think about the genuine Hawke legacy. And the genuine Hawke legacy was faith in the Australian people, faith in the Australian character, and belief in the Australian polity. And Hawke's approach was that we bring people together, whether at the neighbourhood level or at the national level. We get people together, we talk problems through, we talk and we formulate joint compromise positions. That's what he did. They were great reforms, but those reforms came off the back of a lot of political compromises. There was political heroism, but there were political compromises. So that's what I'd say. Let's, just a few days after the death of Bob Hawke and the wonderful memorial service for him at the Opera House last week, think of the Hawke legacy and attempting to make it work.
That is a beautiful note to end on, and I think what he did is also what we have done tonight, coming together. And I want to thank you all for coming along. It's been fantastic, Paul, to have you here. Thank you so much. Paul Kelly, everybody.
Paul Kelly and Sally Warhaft, recorded in front of a live audience on Tuesday, the 18th of June, 2019. This series comes to you from the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.